Okay, so I want you to imagine the sheer panic of like a sudden, completely unannounced liquidation of the world's most powerful mega corporation.
Oh, wow. Yeah, just total overnight collapse.
Right, like the regional executives just flee in the middle of the night, the massive logistical supply chains, they just stop.
The money dries up.
Exactly. The security forces walk off the job because the payroll is gone. And the remaining mid-level employees are just left standing in the dark, looking at each other, trying to figure out who is actually in charge of this crumbling infrastructure.
It's a terrifying scenario.
And then on top of all that, ambitious outsiders start kicking down the front doors, looking to just take over the assets. So the question is, how do you build a functioning society out of that specific brand of chaos?
I mean, it's honestly one of the most profound questions in human history. When the sprawling, interconnected systems that people rely on for survival simply evaporate,
Yeah.
the reorganization process is never clean. It is this messy, violent, and highly creative process of adaptation.
And that adaptation is basically the core mission of our deep dive today. We are looking at a really fascinating, highly detailed historical and anthropological report published by the American newspaper and American TV.
It's a fantastic document.
It really is. And the goal here is to take a magnifying glass to a term you have definitely heard, but one that is burdened with just a massive amount of historical misunderstanding, which is the Anglo-Saxons. So whether you're a history buff or just someone curious about, the architectural foundations of modern Western society, this report lays out the blueprints of how a collapsed civilization basically reboots itself from the ground up.
And to do that properly, the report establishes a really crucial baseline right in the very first chapter.
Okay, lay it on us.
The Anglo-Saxons were not a single homogeneous biological race. That is the foundational thesis here.
Which kind of goes against what a lot of people assume,
Oh,
right?
totally. The term actually represents a sociological process known as ethnogenesis.
Ethnogenesis, okay.
It's the historical formation of a completely new, highly diverse identity created over centuries. I mean, it happens through constant migration, warfare, environmental adaptation, and this is key, the deliberate construction of shared memory.
So we are not talking about like a pure ancestral stock arriving on boats and just setting up a new nation.
Exactly, not at all.
So to understand who these people actually were, we have to look at the mechanics of the world they walked into. We're talking about the early 5th century, right? In the chaotic aftermath of Roman Britain.
And Rome didn't just casually leave. The imperial system fundamentally broke down.
So what did that actually look like on the ground?
Well, the logistics of that breakdown are fascinating. By the early 400s, the Roman Empire was dealing with catastrophic crises on the continent. They had to
Right, they
prioritize.
had to pull resources back.
Exactly. So they withdrew their military legions from Britain, and with the military went the imperial coinage system. See, the Roman economy in Britain was largely driven by army pay. When the coins stopped flowing, the taxation systems collapsed, the mass production of pottery and ironwork just ceased, and the urban centers hollowed out.
So the local Celtic elites, the Romano-Britons, who had been running the province for Rome, were suddenly just left holding the bag.
They had to organize their own defense and agricultural supply chains completely without the machinery of the empire.
Which brings us right back to that corporate liquidation analogy from the start. Like, Rome is the bankrupt megacorp. The Celtic Britons are their regional middle management trying to keep the lights on. And the migrating Germanic tribes from across the North Sea, the Angles, Saxons, Jutes, and Frisians, are basically the aggressive startups who see a massive power vacuum and move in.
That's a great way to put it. They definitely saw the vacuum, but their motivations varied wildly.
How so?
While some of these groups from the continental North Sea zone, what is now like northern Germany, Denmark, and the Netherlands, were actually invited in.
Wait, really? Invited.
The Romano-Britons hired them as mercenaries to defend against other raiders from the north and
Oh,
west.
man. That sounds like a plan that's gonna backfire.
Oh, it did. Once those mercenaries realized their employers had absolutely no way to force them to leave, they turned on them.
Of course.
But then others came purely as raiders looking for movable wealth, while others arrived as entire farming communities just looking for arable land.
Now, this report spends a lot of time debunking a very specific myth about what happened next. The traditional assumption, I think, is that these Germanic arrivals just swept across the island and completely eradicated the native Celtic Britons.
Like a total violent erasure of the original population.
Right.
Yeah, and the archaeological record and modern genetic research completely dismantle that idea.
Thank goodness for DNA, right?
Absolutely. The report highlights ancient DNA studies that sampled the early English gene pool, and they clearly show that the original Britons were not wiped out.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, when distinct cultures collide in a power vacuum, total replacement is actually incredibly rare. What you actually get is a vast, uneven spectrum of interaction.
So it's not just a clean wipe.
No, not at all. There was certainly warfare and violent displacement, sure, but there was also economic coexistence, the payment of tribute, deep intermarriage, and cultural absorption.
I mean, if you are a local Briton living through this, survival basically means looking at who controls the agricultural surplus and who has the strongest war bands.
Right, exactly. Survival is pragmatic.
So over a few generations, you just start adopting their customs and speaking their West Germanic language because it provides social mobility.
Yes.
And I think that is a really vital reminder for you listening. History is rarely a binary story of one group conquering and erasing another. It is this layered reality where people adapt to whatever the prevailing power structure is.
And the regional differences heavily support that too. In the West and the North, places like modern-day Wales and Cornwall, the British identities held strong. They successfully resisted cultural assimilation.
But in the East and South.
In the East and South, Germanic language, burial practices, and material culture became totally dominant. The identity of the early English was forged directly against a living, breathing British presence.
Okay, so we have this incredibly volatile landscape. You have mercenaries, ambitious warlords, native Britons, and new migrants all sharing an island, competing for resources.
Right.
In a world without Roman law, a police force, or a standing army, how does a society avoid just descending into a perpetual apocalyptic bloodbath?
Well, they managed it by developing a highly rigid social structure and a radically different approach to justice.
Okay, tell me more.
Anglo-Saxon society was built entirely on the concept of kinship and obligation. You had a strict social pyramid.
Like kings at the top.
Yep. Kings and ealdormen, the high nobility, sat at the top. Below them were the thanes.
The things.
Yeah, the warrior aristocrats whose status was tied to land ownership and military service. Then you had the seorls, the free peasant farmers who bore the brunt of the agricultural work and local
And at
defense.
the bottom.
At the very bottom were the dependent peasants and the theos, who were enslaved people.
So status dictated literally your everyday reality.
Exactly. And this is where the report dives into the concept of wergild, which roughly translates to man price.
Man price.
Yeah. The law stated that killing or injuring a person required a specific payment scaled entirely to their rank in that social pyramid.
Okay, let me pause you there. Because looking at this mechanistically, putting a literal price tag on a severed hand or a human life reads a bit like a medieval protection racket.
Right, yeah.
I mean, it basically sounds like you pay the fee and you get away with the crime, like a mafia payoff.
It is so tempting to view it through a modern lens, but what's fascinating here is if we look at the mechanics of a kin-based society, wergild was a highly sophisticated tool for conflict management.
Okay, how so?
Well, in a world without state police, justice is enforced by your extended family. If someone injured your brother, your family is honor-bound to retaliate against the attacker's family.
Right, a blood feud.
Exactly. And that triggers a multi-generational blood feud, which destroys agricultural productivity and destabilizes the entire region.
Because everyone is literally too busy fighting to harvest the crop.
Exactly the problem. So, wergild did not abolish the concept of the feud, it formalized and redirected it.
Oh, I see.
By legally establishing a calculable price for life and injury, the society created an off-ramp for violence. It converted chaotic vengeance into a state-recognized settlement.
That is actually genius.
Right. The guilty party had to swear an oath and pay the compensation, often in cattle, land, or silver. And that restored honor to the victim's family without requiring them to draw swords.
It was the crucial bridge from tribal revenge to institutional royal justice.
Exactly. It forces people to use economics rather than violence to settle scores.
But managing local feuds with cattle payments doesn't scale up to a unified nation. To build a functioning state out of these disparate groups, they needed a shared narrative and a larger organizational framework, right?
Which brings us to the political reality of the Heptarchy. Over centuries of consolidation, the island settled into roughly seven major competing kingdoms: Wessex, Mercia, Northumbria, Kent, East Anglia, Essex, and Sussex.
Seven kingdoms. Got it.
Though the report notes that Heptarchy is really just a convenient shorthand for historians. The actual geopolitics were incredibly fluid.
Like constantly shifting borders.
Oh, yeah. Kingdoms swallowed each other, fractured, and shifted borders based on the martial strength of whoever happened to be sitting on the throne at the time.
So they basically hit a ceiling of complexity. And to break through that ceiling, something had to disrupt the board. And the report points to the arrival of Christianity.
Yes. Specifically, Pope Gregory sending Augustine on a mission to Kent in 597.
And how does one guy change the whole game?
Augustine's arrival fundamentally altered the trajectory of the island. The earlier Anglo-Saxons were largely pagan, you know, relying on oral traditions and local shrines. The Roman Church didn't just bring theology, it brought an entire administrative operating system.
Oh, wow. The operating system, I like that.
Yeah. Christianity reintroduced Latin, which brought the technology of writing on parchment. It brought episcopal organization, which divided land into manageable dioceses.
Right.
And it brought the Julian calendar, which allowed for long-term agricultural and political planning.
It also gives kings a completely new justification for power.
Exactly.
Before, a king was just the warlord who won the most battles. Now, a king is divinely anointed by God.
Yeah.
That gives them the authority to issue written law codes and actually participate in continental diplomacy with the rest of Europe.
Yes, and monasteries quickly became the new centers of economic organization and intellectual life. And out of that intellectual life came figures like the monk Bede, who wrote the ecclesiastical history of the English people in the 8th century.
I love the section on Bede. The report highlights his work as a massive turning point in how these people understood themselves.
Oh, totally.
He essentially constructs the concept of the English retroactively. Like a brilliant PR guy, he looks at all these warring regional kingdoms and weaves a narrative that they share a unified providential destiny.
He built a shared historical memory on parchment.
Right. Planting the idea of a unified England in the minds of the elites long before it existed on a map.
And while Bede provided the historical mythology, the evolution of the language provided the everyday glue.
The language is key.
Oh, absolutely. Old English began as a pragmatic cluster of West Germanic dialects. It provided the structural core of the language, the everyday vocabulary for survival.
Words we still use right now, like man, wife, house, bread, water, night.
Exactly. And as Christianity took root, Latin layered over the top of it, providing the vocabulary for law, religion, and higher learning.
So they're culturally consolidating.
Yeah.
The language is binding them together, and they are beginning to view themselves as a collective people.
Yes, they're starting to unite.
And right as they establish this identity, they are hit with an external pressure test that changes the geography and culture of Britain forever.
The Viking Age begins.
Here we go.
Yeah. The report marks the late 8th century as the turning point, starting with the deeply traumatic raid on the monastery of Lindisfarne in 793.
Which was a huge shock.
Huge. For the Anglo-Saxons, monasteries were supposed to be inviolable sanctuaries of wealth and learning. The realization that these seaborne raiders saw them merely as, you know, undefended banks was a massive psychological shock.
And it escalates from hit-and-run raids to an existential threat by the 860s with the arrival of what the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle calls the Great Heathen Army.
Right.
Because these Vikings didn't show up just to steal silver chalices and sail home before winter.
No, they came to conquer, to extract wealth systematically, and settle the land. The logistics of the Great Army just completely overwhelmed the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms.
They just steamrolled them.
Basically. The Vikings dismantled Northumbria, conquered East Anglia, and fractured Mercia, establishing a vast zone of Scandinavian control in the north and east known as the Danelaw.
And because they settled in the Danelaw, they fundamentally infused the culture. Old Norse began bleeding into everyday Old English.
The linguistic fusion was so deep because the languages were closely related. If we look at the vocabulary they left behind, it isn't just military terminology.
What kind of words?
It's the language of everyday life and domestic organization. Words like sky, egg, window, sister, husband, and crucially, the word law itself, are all Norse contributions that permanently altered how the English spoke and thought.
So, with the Great Army rolling over half the island, the obvious question is, why didn't they just absorb the entire territory?
Well, they nearly did. By the 870s, Wessex was the last Anglo-Saxon kingdom standing, and it was pushed to the absolute brink.
Just barely hanging on.
Exactly. Its survival rested entirely on the leadership and massive institutional reforms of King Alfred the Great.
Alfred.
Yeah. Alfred realized that the traditional Anglo-Saxon method of warfare, raising a temporary militia to fight a pitched battle, was completely useless against a highly mobile enemy that could fortify a position faster than an army could be raised.
So he has to completely rewire how the state operates.
He fundamentally restructured the logistics of the kingdom. He implemented a system of fortified market towns called burhs.
Burhs.
Yeah. These were not just castles for the elite. They were garrison grids built across Wessex, positioned strategically so that no farm was more than a day's march from safety.
That's a massive public works project.
It was. And to man these defenses permanently, he created the Burgle Hittage, which was a highly complex taxation system that assessed land values to ensure every foot of the defensive walls had a man assigned to defend it.
And he also built a navy to challenge the Vikings on the water before they could even land.
Yes.
There's an incredible historical irony. The Vikings arrived to dismantle the Anglo-Saxons, but the immense pressure of trying to survive the Vikings is exactly what forces the Anglo-Saxons to modernize.
That pressure literally forged a centralized state. The older rival kingdoms were dead.
Right.
When Alfred's descendants systematically pushed back and eventually reclaimed the Danelaw, they were not just kings of Wessex anymore. They emerged as the kings of a unified England. They standardized coinage, divided the land into administrative shires managed by local reeves, which gives us the modern word sheriff, and built a royal chancery.
Wow.
By the 11th century, the Anglo-Saxon state was arguably the wealthiest, most monetized, and bureaucratically advanced kingdom in Western Europe.
Which is an incredible triumph of ethnogenesis and state building.
Definitely.
But building a wealthy, highly organized, and easily taxable kingdom paints a massive target on your back.
Yeah.
That wealth attracts the ultimate disruption in the year 1066.
Right. The Norman Conquest. William the Conqueror crosses the Channel, defeats the last Anglo-Saxon king at the Battle of Hastings, and permanently alters the trajectory of the nation.
And the events of 1066 are essentially the endpoint of the Anglo-Saxon political era.
Yes, they are.
But the modern legacy of this history is highly contested. And reading through the source report, there is a substantial section that addresses how the term Anglo-Saxon carries significant modern political baggage today.
It really does.
It dives into highly charged debates surrounding white identity, WASPy culture, and claims about Western civilization, analyzing arguments from both left-wing and right-wing perspectives. And, I mean, just to be completely clear for you listening, our purpose here is not to take a side or endorse any of these contemporary political viewpoints.
Right, exactly.
We are strictly navigating what the authors of our source document have laid out regarding the historical realities and the modern misapplications of the term.
And the scholarly consensus detailed in the report draws a very sharp line. In history and archaeology, Anglo-Saxon remains a completely necessary, valid, period label.
Oh.
It accurately describes the early medieval English-speaking societies that developed between the fall of Roman Britain and the Norman conquest. It categorizes a specific era of law, art, literature, and administrative innovation.
But the report stresses that turning that period label into a civilizational myth of racial purity is historically illiterate.
Completely. It denies the actual evidence we've spent this whole deep dive exploring. The people of early medieval England were a highly mixed, constantly evolving regional hybrid.
Right, like we talked about with the DNA.
Yeah. Their society was the product of migration, violent conflict, deep intermarriage, and profound cultural fusion between continental migrants, the indigenous Celtic Britons, and Scandinavian settlers.
So the idea of a pure ethnic essence is completely at odds with the mechanics of ethnogenesis that actually built the society.
100%.
Okay, so going back to the actual mechanics of 1066, William the Conqueror wins at Hastings. He takes control of this wealthy, highly structured machine.
Yep.
Does he sweep away the Anglo-Saxon infrastructure the way the Germanic tribes swept away the Roman infrastructure?
He didn't have to. The Norman strategy was basically surgical decapitation. They killed or exiled the top tier of the native English nobility and church leadership, replacing them entirely with Norman loyalists.
Oh, wow. Just taking the top off.
Exactly. They seized the massive estates and built stone castles to enforce their rule, but they deliberately kept the underlying Anglo-Saxon administrative engine.
It worked.
Because it worked. Yeah. The local courts, the shires, the incredibly efficient taxation networks, they kept them because that infrastructure was exactly what made the kingdom so wealthy in the first place.
Which created a deeply layered society. You have Norman-French domination sitting firmly on top of deep Anglo-Saxon foundations.
Yes. French becomes the exclusive language of the aristocracy, the royal courts, and the government.
And English is abruptly pushed down the social ladder. It basically becomes the language of the subjugated majority, the people working the land and paying the taxes.
Exactly.
So when we strip away the myths and look at the actual history, what's the true legacy of the Anglo-Saxon? Right. It isn't a biological lineage. It is structural and linguistic.
Yeah, it's the geographic divisions of the local shires that still echo in how land is managed today. It's the early mechanisms of royal justice and conflict resolution that evolved out of systems like Wehrguild.
They took a collapsed imperial province, navigated centuries of chaos and external threats, and built administrative reality that was so robust, even the people who conquered them utilized it to rule.
Which is pretty amazing.
It is. Which leaves us with a final thought to mull over. After the Norman conquest in 1066, the English language was essentially demoted. It was a peasant language, spoken by the commoners laboring in the mud while the Norman elites conducted the business of the state in French.
Right.
Yet it was that subjugated peasant language, the foundational everyday Germanic words for earth, water, night, and bread, that stubbornly refused to die. It absorbed thousands of French and Latin vocabulary words over the centuries and eventually grew into the global lingua franca of the modern world.
That's a great point.
So, think back to the mechanics of history we explored today. It is the people at the bottom, the ones doing the everyday work, managing the fields and adapting to survive, whose culture often possesses the deepest endurance. So look around at the cultural or linguistic forces operating today that mainstream society considers unofficial, underdog, or lower class. Could one of those overlooked forces be the foundational bedrock of a global language 1,000 years from now?